Hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Morning. Before we begin, Mr. Van Wagner, I want to welcome students from Verona High School. Would they please stand? Well, thank you for coming this morning. You may be seated. These students are here with our Court with Class program, a program that's sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin, and it is a national award-winning program. We invite students from all the high schools in Wisconsin to attend an oral argument. The students have received materials about this case, and at noon, they will meet with a justice of the court to discuss the procedures this court uses in hearing and deciding cases. And everyone is invited to join the students at noon for this presentation. Well, we've been happy to meet you. Let me now introduce the court. On my far right is Justice David Prosser. Seated next to him is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Justice Bradley is the justice with whom you will meet at noon. Seated to my immediate right is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice John Wilcox, and to his left, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far left, Justice Diane Sykes. With those introductions made, I will call the first case, State versus Meeks. Christopher Van Wagner will argue on behalf of the defendant, Jerry Meeks.
May it please the court, my name is Chris Van Wagner of Van Wagner & Wood, and I am pro bono counsel in place of the late Dean Howard Eisenberg for Mr. Jerry Meeks, the defendant, appellant, petitioner in this case.
If you'd explain for the students here,
sure,
what pro bono counsel means.
I have agreed to take this case without compensation or reimbursement of expenses, and I've done so in part because the late Dean Howard Eisenberg of the Marquette Law School did that routinely, and I didn't see any reason to change that, although the public defender asked me to take this case. And second, I viewed it as more of a professional opportunity here than the compensation would amount to anyway, so on that basis.
And I want to tell you that you will get the court's thanks. That's the payment.
Maybe not the decision.
Yes, whether or not that's a thing of value, I don't know.
Judge Crabb has a tendency to thank jurors before they begin their deliberations so they don't perceive it as a thanks for their verdict. may it please the court, I am not routinely before this court. Indeed, this is my first appearance here. I am routinely before trial court judges on homicide cases in which the public defender has appointed me quite often. And so this case raises for me far greater questions at this point than it answers, which is why we're here. The question, the simple question, can be addressed in the context of my very first meeting with an appointed client, person charged with first-degree homicide, as was Mr. Meeks here. I have one goal in my first meeting with a client, and that is to make sure that at the end of that meeting, that client trusts me and will be as candid with me as their personality and their character permits. Because without that, I cannot conceivably do my job as their attorney. If this court were to take the state's view in this case, which I concede is probably the greater, the more often endorsed view as of today in courts around the country, and that is that a trial counsel may offer an opinion in a competency proceeding as to his or her client's competency. If this court were to adopt that greater view, it would probably leave me with an absolute obligation in that first meeting.
Which, well, counsel.
Yes.
We interrupt, you know, at will here.
Having only been in the Seventh Circuit, I'll get used to it.
And I want to get really specific with you because I think specificity is important here. You use the term offer an opinion about the competency of a client. And yet that is not precisely what was done here. Isn't that correct?
I respectfully disagree, Justice Babbage.
Okay.
Judge Lamellis, in her oral ruling, quite clearly drew the conclusion that had to be drawn when the only dots on the table were connected after Scholl's testimony, Attorney Scholl. And that was that, and I quote from that ruling, which is in the appendix, Attorney Scholl testified that if there was any scintilla of doubt in her mind about a person's competency, she would have brought that to my attention, skipping over a few words. I have really no doubt in my mind that if the defendants, meaning Meeks, cognitive limitations were such that someone with Ms. Scholl's experience and commitment, that if it had come to her notice, it would have been brought to my attention and she did not.
I read that too.
Yes.
I have not read the trial transcript. I have not read the transcript. But the State, very carefully on page 10 and 11 of its brief, describes Attorney Sholley's testimony. And the State seems to disagree with Judge Lamellis's explanation of what Attorney Sholley really testified to, because on page 11, the State says, Attorney Sholley was never explicitly asked her opinion of Meek's competence, nor did she offer her opinion. So I, at least as I read that, my thought was that Judge Lamellis may have been mistaken in her characterization, and that, in fact, we are really dealing not with an offer, or not with an offer of an opinion, but really, at best, a failure to do something which, ipso facto, resulted in an implicit offer of an opinion. And I think those distinctions are important. Maybe they're not.
We have to remember the procedural context in which attorney
first of all, could you comment on Judge Lamellis's? I mean, you have said that I was wrong in saying that she offered an opinion. You say Judge Lamellis said she offered an opinion, and yet the State seems to say here that she did not offer an opinion. And unless the transcript proves me wrong, I suspect that Judge Lamellis was simply inaccurate in her recollection of what Attorney Sholley really testified to.
Judge Lamellis never said or never quoted Attorney Sholley as offering an explicit opinion. But the context was this. The State, not the defense, offered the testimony of a prior counsel to do what? To show factual history from 2 years earlier from which it was clearly, if not explicitly, asking the judge to conclude that since he was not incompetent then, or there was not even a scintilla or whiff of possibility of incompetence, then he's not now, which is exactly what Judge Lamellis did. What does that constitute from the lawyer? The lawyer, obviously with counsel in tow for fear of justice concern, I'm sure, testified, what do I do in every case? Mr. Meeks was three of her cases. So, in effect, she has given testimony by omission.
Right.
That, in my opinion, Mr. Meeks, in the three cases I allowed him to plead, including the Alpha case.
To me, that's important. That's a very important distinction. And it is not offering an opinion. It is giving testimony, the silence of which implicitly raises this.
And
the reason that I think it's important, because I want you to go on, is because we've got a case, State versus Johnson, that says that an attorney has a duty, a positive obligation to raise the issue of competency if they have any doubt about competency. And if, in fact, that is a duty of an attorney, then my thought is that when an attorney doesn't do that, then they are essentially saying there is no question in their mind. And now you've caught that attorney on the horns of a dilemma from which they cannot escape if your position prevails.
I respectfully disagree with that last conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
Johnson says that if, well, first of all, the statute says that if a court has reason to doubt the competency of a defendant, then it shall commence the procedures for evaluating competency. I have been in this position in homicide cases. How do I address the court? I say to the court in a written motion, we request a mental competency evaluation or a competency assessment by the court. I have reason to doubt the defendant's competency.
Well, counsel, let me ask you this. You say you've represented many clients in the past. I take it that there are many cases then in which you have not raised the issue of competency.
Virtually all of them. Very few have I raised it.
So in each of those cases then, you as a good attorney, competent attorney, are essentially saying that you have no doubt as to the competency. Are you not?
I don't think you can draw that conclusion. I don't think
Then you should have raised the issue of competency, because Johnson says that you have that responsibility.
If I have reason to doubt my client's competence in a trial court, yes, I raise it. So I guess the answer to your question is yes, of course I would raise it. And I have raised it in those cases in which I have had that reason to doubt. But to go beyond that poses for me some major problems which go to the heart of the attorney-client privilege. And I understand you're focusing on, was there ever a privileged communication revealed? I want to address that question from the other side. When I sit down with that client in the first meeting, if I told that client, I want you to know that while I sit here, I'm going to be looking at your eyes and your hands and your feet and your tics and your personality and the way your answers change. And someday, I'm going to be possibly called to the witness stand against you in a future proceeding in which some other lawyer later thinks you have a competency question, even though I may not. And therefore, as you sit with me, perhaps you would be better off not to be in my presence to talk to me. And this poses a real problem, because as I sit with that client, I have to anticipate that this is a possibility if it comes up. That's exactly what happened to Attorney Scholl. Did she sit with that client and say, I may someday testify against you? And so if the purpose, and I want to say the state has talked about a defense thrust for general concerns. I want to talk about real particular concerns in this case. When an attorney takes the stand later and gives testimony at the request of the state against that client, in effect, even in a hearing that is less adversarial than most, it cuts to the heart of the reason for the privilege in a criminal case. I must have as much trust and candor out of that client as I can get, because I wasn't there.
So basically what you're saying, this procedure, although we are concentrating on the testimony and whether or not it was a privileged communication, confidentiality, but basically what I hear is this type of procedure that went on here is, to say the least, unusual. Because normally in a competency, and I was looking at your blue brief, page appendix 27, where at least you told us, or we have, that we know what Mr. Meeks's IQ is and his mental age of, and it says here, 8 to 10 years old, 58 for an IQ. And I just wanted to, because when I read that, but that would be the normal way of someone testifying on the stand as to whether or not this client was competent, correct? You'd have a psychiatrist get up there, et cetera. So what I'm asking is that do you find that this procedure was unusual?
No question about it, Justice. It was highly unusual. And you know, we often hear that unusual facts make bad and very limited law. But addressing it on the very factual basis in this case, it was highly unusual, but were this court to hold that a state in a competency hearing may go through the roster of prior attorneys, hand them subpoenas because no competency motion were filed or no competency requests were made, and were to have those attorneys lined up in the hall to testify against the first-degree homicide defendant in a competency hearing, that would be an unseemly turn of events that would undercut the reason for the privilege, which
but
is...
But what if instead of being lined up to testify as to the competency of a particular defendant, they were lined up to testify as to their own competency? That is, unless I have a question of competency, I don't raise it. which is really what happened here.
If that's all that, if that's all that was offered here by whichever side, then it wasn't relevant and it shouldn't have been relied upon. But the question that this Court has granted review on is whether we get into the realm of privilege. And I honestly believe that when an attorney gets on the stand and says, in any of my cases, if I doubt competency, I raise it, if there's even a scintilla of doubt, I raise it, I am saying I didn't raise it here. That's obvious by the record. Therefore, you know that I concluded from my interactions and conversations that I didn't doubt it. And it's that – I think that's a privileged
– Well, I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but I'm enjoying this interchange with the counsel. Maybe your objection is more that of relevancy than attorney-client.
No.
Because if, in fact, all that they are testifying to as what occurred here, and I stress that I raise questions of competency when I think they're there, and I don't raise them when I don't believe they're there, and I'm not and with no reference to any specific individual, maybe your objection should be that shouldn't be allowed because of relevancy.
Well, as a factual matter, that was offered and rejected and in this case. But
okay.
I want to answer that with a hypothetical. As the sitting in court attorney, Mr. Nance, if I want to get at the inferential or implied conclusion that is being offered by the State through the former counsel's testimony and being accepted and relied upon by Judge Lamelis, as the trial court attorney for the Mr. Meeks in the competency hearing, how do I attack that without going into privileged material? I mean, the State suggests that the greater body of authority saying that you limit the testimony just to the attorney's view of competency, which I think can be applied here, but you stop there and you don't get into privileged matters, begs the question, because the opinion, as in the case of any opinion, is drawn upon facts. And if I, as Mr. Nance, want to challenge that, I have to go into privileged matters. What did you talk about, Ms. Scholl? Tell us about the interactions. And how else do I attack the credibility? So it's a real practical problem for the competency hearing procedure. If we're going to allow present or former counsels to get on the stand and testify, we force the issue of privilege, even if it didn't come out here. Because a good cross-examiner knows that the heart of the opinion is not the expertise of the lawyer, what lawyer after Johnson's going to get on the stand and give a different answer, but rather the attorney's going to want to get into the facts that are privileged in order to attack it. How can you allow that former testimony or the former attorney to testify while prohibiting the current counsel to test the validity of that opinion?
It seems to me then, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I want to make sure that I'm understanding your argument. You are saying that when this is offered, this kind of testimony, even if it doesn't refer to any specific defendant, the necessary building blocks to reach the statement, I raise competency when I question it, and I don't raise it when I don't question it, is dependent upon communications between the lawyer and the client that are protected within the lawyer-client privilege.
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. So you have a foundational issue that clearly addresses privileged information, and you also have the practical competency evaluation by the court. You have the problem there, which is I, as the lawyer for the in-court defendant, want to find out. And if I do so, I am eliciting privileged information, which the client, at this point, we don't know if the client's competent to waive. I would hate to raise the specter of in every case where competency becomes an issue for a person with repeat counsels, that we have to appoint a perhaps guardian ad litem for that person to protect the privilege, which would add a layer of bureaucracy. It would be so much easier to have a bright line rule. An attorney in court who suggests the possibility of incompetence or a question of competence has done his or her job, and that's when the experts take over and witnesses other than attorneys for the defendant.
Mr. Van Wagner.
Yes, Your Honor.
The majority opinion in this case was written by Judge Shudson.
Yes.
He seems to rely on the idea that there are some duties as officers of the court that are at issue here. Do you take any issue with his comments in that regard, or do you agree with him?
After 20 years on both sides of the criminal court spectrum, I take absolute issue with the suggestions, even if dicta, that the duty of the lawyer to the court overrides the concern about privilege. And this is why. It goes back again to my original comments. When my client has to have a level of trust in me to let me represent them vigorously, even on the issue of competency, if I then have to reveal things, some of the more detailed things as cited in some of the cases, such as how the client interacted with me, I am undercutting the trust that is the basis for the privilege. And I also believe that in the one context that we are here today, the so-called lone wolf defense attorney standing next to evil incarnate before the court has a duty to that person to make sure that they don't do anything to hurt that person's interest. And by the way, there's an unseemly footnote to that. We now have a battle of lawyers. We have the non-testifying in-court lawyer versus the testifying former lawyer. It used to be competency was a battle of experts supplemented by facts. But if you were to uphold the state's position here and the Court of Appeals position, now we're going to having trial counsels feeling the compulsion to withdraw and testify because we have a battle of the lawyers' opinions. The in-court lawyer, Mr. Nance, didn't testify. He advocated.
Mr. Van Wagner. That was the reason for my question as to the this type of procedure, because I found it at least unusual based on having been a trial judge for a number of years and been involved in the competency hearings. It would raise some of the questions that have been, you know, talked about here. So the reason, and that's why I said in your brief, you put in there's a substantial amount of, this is a transcript of proceedings starting on 1 through pages 43, as far as that is the typical testimony that would be out there, the expert testifying before the court.
Yes. I agree, Justice Wilcox. And, in fact, just because of that unusual fact scenario here, which could, if upheld, lead to a repetition in any competency hearing, we end up with a very ungainly mechanism, a mechanism by which the state may call prior attorneys. There was a suggestion made in the trial court. It was in the course of the objection to Scholl's testimony. The transcript speaks for itself. The court can look at it and conclude, as courts of review always do, that if an issue weren't raised, it searches the record to make sure that there would have been some explanation for not raising it. That comes up much more in the Mockner context. The bottom line here is the transcript from an experienced attorney allows Judge Lamellis, without any testimony, to say competency wasn't raised before, so if it's present, it's new. I think I can reach that conclusion safely on this record, without an admission by Attorney Scholl that she had reason to doubt it and didn't raise it, which hooks her on the horns of the dilemma, Justice Babbage, that she raised. I honestly believe that at that point, where the attorney was called by the state to the stand, things promised to become, from this day forward, if you uphold the appeals court, so cumbersome and costly and time-consuming and issue-laden that it's much easier to conclude with a bright-line rule.
Mr. Van Wagner.
Yes.
Justice Prosser has a question.
Yes.
Well, I want you to clarify, please. Suppose Mr. Nance had not questioned competency, and now you were representing Mr. Meeks on appeal. Or in a post-conviction motion.
Yes.
What would the procedure be there, and how does that fit into? You referred to the Mockner hearing.
So that I understand your question, is it if I come in as post-conviction counsel, Mr. Nance did not raise it, simply allowed the plea to go forward and the 40-year sentence to be imposed, what would be my role?
And what would be Mr. Nance's role?
Well, in that context, if I raised a Mockner claim, an ineffective assistance claim, because I felt I had garnered enough evidence from psychologists of my own that at the time he failed to raise it, he should have, I would bring the Mockner claim And then I would be challenging the efficacy of the prior lawyer's representation. That is one of the very specific exceptions to the privilege rule, that when a lawyer's performance or fees are at issue, the privilege is accepted. So I believe my role would be to raise the issue.
But wouldn't Mr. Nance's role then be hitting himself against you? I mean, should he turn against his client, Mr. Meeks, and say, well, I thought he was competent?
Mr. Meeks is the person who raises the Mockman challenge. His lawyer is merely the communicator of that challenge. So I, as his last lawyer, am saying that Mr. Meeks is asking this court to overturn his plea because he was incompetent and his lawyer, in an ineffective assistance fashion, failed to raise that issue. And that happens, well, happens way too often because it's the last refuge of the guilty, I suppose. But the fact of the matter is that every time you raise an ineffective assistance claim, you are pitting yourself against him, and that's why the rule has the exception that allows the testimony from the attorney about the challenged acts or challenged omissions.
So that all
the statute allows that, Justice.
All that we're concerned about here is the interpretation of a rule.
We are concerned first and foremost about whether Mr. Meeks's attorney-client privilege was abrogated, if indirectly and if unconsciously. Certainly, there was enough suggestion. That's first. And I say that because Attorney Scholl conveyed implicitly that she felt he was competent, that led to a finding which contravened all the experts. The people who are the experts all said he would never regain competence. The attorney said he was competent when I represented him, in effect. So, no, we're not concerned about just the rule. We're concerned about, first and foremost, Mr. Meeks' privilege and whether it was abrogated.
But the privilege depends on the rule, doesn't it?
Well, the privilege is codified, but it also has some origins in common law. And under the rule, there is no exception that seems to fit this context. The State's contention is that there was nothing privileged. But if you get past that, then here we're clearly contravening the rule. And if the rule is intended, as all rules are, to both protect the privilege and provide for the orderly procession of cases through the system, to uphold the Court of Appeals in this case will cause a descent into a maelstrom of confusion, cost, and bureaucracy each time this comes up, when we line up the former lawyers in the hall on either side. So I suggest that the clarification of the rule serves the purpose of protecting the privilege by making it clear there is no more judicial exception, that it is privileged information and it cannot come out, and second, that we ensure that we don't fall into this, as Justice Wilcox has said, this rather unusual procedural context.
Mr. Van Wagner.
Yes, Justice.
It seems to me that you are necessarily arguing for a rule of law that no adverse inference may be drawn by an attorney's failure to raise the issue of competency. Is that accurate?
I hadn't thought about it that way. Can I have a moment to reflect on that?
No adverse inference.
No, I think all the cases of ineffective assistance, both
I'm not talking about ineffective, just, you know, in cases like this. Because what happened essentially was Judge LaMalis drew an adverse influence against Mr. Meeks by Attorney Schally's failure to raise the issue. And you're saying that's error. And it seems to me that can only be an error of law, and it's an error of law because it's not the other side to the coin raised in Johnson, i.e., you know, Johnson says you've got a duty to raise it. But I think what you're arguing, all this leads to, I should say, is a rule of law that you can't allow a judge to draw an adverse influence by an attorney's failure to raise the issue of competency because that necessarily invades the privilege.
I guess I respectfully disagree. I'm advocating for a rule of law that says that you can't call a former counsel to the stand and have them give any testimony that would be allowed as the basis for that inference to be drawn.
I think it's the same thing.
It may be a distinction without a difference, but in this case, I respectfully think that that's what I'm arguing for.
Well, if that's the inference, then you don't need the lawyer on the stand. You know, all you have to do is say he was charged in years A, B, and C, and tried in years A, B, and C, all of which are close in time to the present. and there was no claim of incompetence. Therefore, the inference is that counsel had no reasonable doubt as to the client's competence. Now, you wouldn't object to that.
I believe that's a permissible inference.
It is a permissible inference. Is that what you said?
I suggest yes. The court it is.
And therefore, you don't need the lawyer to testify that the lawyer had no reasonable doubt or explain what happened, because the inference is there was no doubt because it was the lawyer's obligation to do it. Therefore, you don't have the you don't need the lawyer's testimony in this case.
I think that's correct, Chief Justice, and I believe that also answers Justice Prosser's question.
I'm following up on his questions. Now, let us suppose that we think the privilege was violated. What happens? Do you overturn the conviction here?
Johnson says that there has to be a remand to the trial court for a determination of whether or not it is possible to do a nunc pro tunc determination of competence on the record as so proscribed. And so I have no basis upon which to say that Johnson has been overruled or limited in that respect. And so I think the appropriate remedy here is not what I prayed for in my brief, now that you bring that up, but rather a remand to determine if that's true, if it can be determined.
All right. My next question to you is, since we agreed, at least tentatively, that the inference is permissible just from the fact of his having been tried before within a reasonable time, then, and let's just for the moment say that there's been a violation of the privilege communication, why isn't this harmless error? Because the Lamalis could have made this inference without the testimony, right?
She could have.
And she did from this testimony. But either way, the inference is there. Why isn't this just harmless error?
For this reason. The normal standard of review for a competency determination, whether it was sufficient, as addressed in the appeals court here, is a highly deferential one. It's highly deferential because it is the trial judge in the best position to evaluate the testimony of the four experts and the other facts offered. It appears on this record that Judge Lamalis gave great weight to both the character and reputation and experience of Attorney Scholl. It's unusual to see that commentary, I think. Trial lawyers love to hear it, but not necessarily in this context. But as a practical matter, you cannot discern on this record whether that was the straw that broke the camel's back. If I guess the question is, but for that testimony, would Judge Lamalis have reached the same result? And the answer is not stated on the record.
Weak answer, counsel. I think you ought to reconsider your answer to my question, because the Chief has very adroitly raised the issue of judicial notice. Why can't a judge like Judge Lamalis simply take judicial notice any time that the lawyer that represented Mr. Meeks or whomever in the past didn't raise it, and therefore that lawyer concluded there was no question of competency? And that's why I thought that you might want to be arguing for a rule of law that you can't draw any adverse consequences, because if you can, then you don't need the lawyer.
There's a difference between a permissive inference and a judicially noticed fact. A judicially noticed fact is one not subject to dispute. A permissive inference has to be weighed against the great weight of the rest of the testimony. And here, but for the discussion of Attorney Scholl's character and her great experience in all these cases, it's not clear on record that Lamalis would have reached that same conclusion. But it wasn't a judicially noticed fact that he was not, that there was no competence issue. I believe it's a permissive inference, just as it would be in an ineffective assistance claim, that the lawyer had a reason for the tactic, unless you've shown otherwise, which is why Mockman requires the testimony of a lawyer. But in this context, I believe it's only a permissive inference, and I believe that it cannot simply be harmless error, because we don't know what conclusion Judge Lamelas would have reached. We have a secondary problem, and that is, at this point, if it isn't harmless error and it has to go back, we still don't know if that determination can be made non-pro-ton either. So.
Thank you.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Mr. Van Wagner.
Thank you for all of you.
You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
I will.
Yes.
I'll try not to use it.
I will use it.
Counsel, we now hear from Eileen M. Cray, Assistant Attorney General of the State of Wisconsin, representing the State of Wisconsin.
Good morning.
Ms. Cray.
And I am Assistant Attorney General Lee Cray, representing the State, the respondent in this case.
Counsel, make sure you speak up. I'm
okay. Sorry about that. It's the State's position that Attorney Scholes did not violate Mr. Meek's attorney-client privilege because she came nowhere near to revealing or disclosing confidential communications. And what we're dealing with here is an evidentiary rule, 905.032, and a statutory construction of that rule. And that rule prohibits lawyers from disclosing confidential communications and those kind of communications that were made for the purpose of rendering legal services. What is confidential, what is privileged, is the substance of those communications, not the fact that communications occurred. It's the substance of those communications, not the attorney's observation of a client while they are communicating.
Counsel, let me give you then, in raising the concern of your defense counsel that it precludes any cross-examination, are you suggesting that former counsel can say, yeah, I have an opinion that my client 3 years ago when I represented him was competent? Is it your position that's acceptable testimony without violating the privilege?
Yes.
Okay. So you go the route that former attorney can, although it's arguable whether this former attorney did or did not opine.
She did not, is our position. Well, but yes.
But it's the State's position a former attorney can opine on the competency explicitly, right?
Yes.
Then when you come to cross-examination, now, in that situation where your former attorney is opining on your competency, how can you cross-examine the underpinnings of that attorney without being forced to waive attorney-client privilege?
I think you can cross-examine that person on the basis for their opinion without revealing confidential statements, things that were said between the attorney, and in these ways. You can ask them, what did the client seem to understand what you were saying? Was the client attentive? Was the client in control of their emotions? Did they seem to be hallucinating? Was your client able to relay to you their interests and what they wanted to do with the case? All of those sorts of things are fair game for cross-examination.
You're suggesting then you can go to kind of conclusory sort of things.
Yes.
But not to the underlying facts or data.
Not to the underlying statements that were made back and forth between the client and the attorney.
Inconsistent with cross-examination of a normal expert witness, where the expert can come and say, this is my opinion, and then leave to cross the underlying data, you're saying that in this kind of a case, has to have a twist. It can't be necessarily the underlying raw data, but rather some kind of more general conclusory things that would not invade the raw data.
That's right. And I think go ahead.
I want to Judge Lamelas here, and this is something that concerns me. Judge Lamelas here had opinions of four psychiatrists that said this person was not competent, four
yes.
psychiatrists. And yet Judge Lamelas concluded the person was competent. On whose opinion did she base that conclusion?
Well, first of all, I think we have to, and it was a close call for her. And I think that's one of the reasons why the state called the former attorney, called former parole agents, because it was a close call. There was a disconnect here between what the experts were finding with this, with Mr. Meeks, and some of their questions about whether he was malingering, and his sort of very selected disability. He had a very selected disability, only on legal things and not on other things.
As I recall, the stuff in the briefs and the record that I saw, that there was question about malingering, and that's why they brought in another psychiatrist who did the IQ test, who kind of then took care of that.
My question is,
since the four experts said they were not competent, on whose opinion did Judge LaMalis base her conclusion that he was competent?
Well, it's not the decision on competence is not a medical decision. It is a legal decision. Judge LaMalis weighed all of the expert testimony, and when you have expert testimony, you don't need to agree with the final opinion, the final decision on that. She used part of the expert opinion, where he exhibited some understanding of the legal system, where it was questioned whether there was malingering. She used the information that she got from the transcripts, from previous plea hearings. She got information from the parole agents, putting that together, and made a legal decision that Mr. Meeks had sufficient understanding and had sufficient competence to understand and assist in his criminal trial.
With regard to this former attorney, following up on prior questions, isn't what Judge LaMalis did tantamount to just saying, "Hey, I can take judicial notice. I have three files of former cases here. No issue of competency was raised. An attorney has an obligation to raise an issue of competency. Therefore, there must not be an issue of competency." Isn't that tantamount to what went on here?
Came close to that. But I think one of the reasons that it was important to have Attorney Scholl's testimony there is that it is more difficult for attorneys to discover problems of competence when you have a person with a developmental disability rather than somebody who has psychiatric psychoses of some sort or psychiatric problems. And within her testimony, she did give her background in that she had represented over 3,000 defendants and had had some special training in identifying competency issues in people with developmental disabilities. So that was sort of the general background. And with that, then the court took the transcripts. And there was no questions very specifically asked Attorney Scholl about Meeks other than things that could be gotten out of the transcript. That is true. And with that, with Attorney Scholl saying that she had this experience and that if she had a scintilla of doubt, she would raise the competency issue, then the court took the transcripts showing that the competency issue had not been raised and made that very reasonable inference from that if Attorney Scholl had had any doubt as to Meeks's competence, she would have raised it. And that is what she took from that testimony.
So just to cap off that line of questioning, I think I hear you saying that a trial judge, cannot take judicial notice of three prior criminal cases in which the issue was not raised.
I think they can.
But you answered Justice Bradley's question by saying, well, this was a special case because Attorney Scholl's had so much background and so many cases, et cetera, and maybe in one of these other three cases, the attorney was, this was the first case.
Well, that may be true. That it added something, certainly, to her inference. Oh.
Can the judge take judicial notice or can't the judge take judicial notice?
The judge can look at a transcript, see that it was not raised, look at a transcript perhaps of a plea hearing and see what kind of questions were asked of the, and can make some inferences from that transcript that it is the, they can, she can infer or the judge can infer that it is the duty of an attorney to raise the competency issue if there's any reason to doubt, and a competent attorney would do that. Now, she's got to make an inference that this person had a competent attorney, I think, is where the disconnect is.
I need to flesh out, then, your answer to Justice Bradley more, because the first thing that came from you in response to Justice Bradley's question was that, hey, here we were dealing not with some, you know, inexperienced first-time attorney, but we were dealing with somebody who had over 3,000 cases, criminal
right.
cases, who had a special knowledge of criminal of competency to proceed.
Right.
So I guess I'm to get down to specifics. In order for the judge to take judicial notice, as you then said in my answer that they could, does the judge have to have some knowledge of the attorney's special expertise in the area of competency or special experience in criminal areas in order to take judicial notice?
I think perhaps it goes more to the weight of the evidence than it goes to its admissibility. I think perhaps the judge can take judicial notice that a competent attorney would raise it and it wasn't raised.
Mm-hmm.
With extra testimony dealing with, in this particular case, the person's special expertise, that gives that evidence more weight.
Counsel, but was there really any weight on the testimony of 3,000 cases? As I read the transcript, Judge LaMalis said, look, I've known this attorney since 1993 when I first came to the bench. She was on my team, and so I've known this attorney.
Mm-hmm.
And that the judge's conclusion about the integrity and reputation of this attorney wasn't based on the mm-hmm. attorney's testimony in court. The transcript, as I read it, indicates that it was based on the judge's knowledge that when she came in 1993, this attorney was an experienced attorney in the public defender's office. She was on my team. Was it for a bench book or something like that? She said, you know, so I've known her. She didn't need her testimony for that. Mm-hmm. That's what her.
Well, that was an issue that Mr. Meeks brought in the Court of Appeals and hasn't brought here, whether it's appropriate for a judge to take judicial notice of those types of things. And I think the Court of Appeals in this case said that if that was a problem here, it was harmless error because there was no dispute over Attorney Scholl's credibility.
Let me see if I can summarize. This may not be the State's position. The inference that he stood trial earlier and therefore was competent because incompetence wasn't raised could have been made by the judge. That the reason the State put on the former attorney was that the former attorney had a reliability and a credibility in her own right as being a very experienced lawyer, and that the weight of her testimony assisted the State's case, so that the mere inference was bolstered by this lawyer rather than, say, a lawyer who was handling his or her first case, who was unknown to the court.
I think that's close to what I'm saying. I'm not so sure that the weight was increased primarily because of the attorney's credibility, but perhaps because of her training.
Okay. That's fine. Now, the State wants a bright-line rule, as I understand it, that a former attorney can testify as to the attorney's and to testify as to facts relating to the competency of a client. Can the attorney give an opinion?
Yes. I believe that the substantial body of case law says that an attorney can give an opinion about competence without violating the privilege.
You don't have to communicate by words, right?
That's true.
And my supposition is that, sitting up here on the bench, being viewed by roughly 50 people in this room, I may not act exactly the same way as I might in my home with just my immediate family, right?
Mm-hmm.
And one wants, and you communicate in a whole variety of ways, right? Gestures,
right.
How you sit,
right.
Your emotions.
Right.
People reduce to tears in a highly emotional situation, which they might not do in a courtroom, knowing that that is a communication.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of this is communicated to the counsel, right?
Right.
And you said you'd ask, was the client attentive? Did the client hallucinate? People may hallucinate but still be competent.
That's correct.
Did he relate his interests, et cetera? All of these really are might very well be nonverbal communications. And yet, the whole privilege is on communication.
I think it goes to what is being communicated. The second half of 905.032 talks about the purpose for the communication being to the rendering of legal services. And I think it's the body of case law suggests that if what you're communicating through your demeanor is whether you're competent or not, it's not the type of thing that was intended to be protected by the privilege.
Oh, but Mr. Van Wagner says when I represent a client, part of my representation is to determine whether they're competent to stand trial. And so you're looking for that. And so maybe the client doesn't intend to communicate competence or incompetence, but he is. When you represent a client, you're looking to see how is that client going to be on a witness stand if you have to put the client on. And that's all part of legal representation. So I have a hard time, as in all cases on privileged communications, of drawing a line here.
I think we have to step back and look at always there's a tension between a privilege and the truth-finding function of the court. And at some point, you do have to draw a line. And the cases, and I think the philosophy and the purpose behind the cases that say that it's okay in this isolated area of the law, in a competency, to have an attorney testify about their opinion about the competence goes to the different nature of a competency proceeding and the different interests, that the adversarial positions aren't as clearly drawn as they are in a criminal trial part, and that the privilege wasn't intended to protect these kind of communications.
Counsel, it seems to me that the analysis of whether or not an attorney can opine on competency may differ when you're assessing a former attorney or a current attorney. As the issue is formed before us, the question, I understand, is whether an attorney's perception or opinion of a former client's competence to stand trial is a confidential communication. That's at least your opposing counsel's formulation of the issue. I read that to emphasize former counsel.
Right.
It seems to me there's a different analysis because of the client's due process right to have his current attorney raise the issue of competency. A client has a due process right to only stand trial if you're competent.
Right.
Am I correct or incorrect that the due process component with regard to your current attorney plays a part, a role in differing and a differing approach?
Meaning that there should be two rules, one for the current attorney, the trial attorney, and one for a former attorney.
Thank you. You said it more artfully, or at least there's a different analysis because the former attorney doesn't have the due process right obligation, as you see in Johnson, because they're because you're not dealing with that.
It may not be as direct, but I think there is a public interest in only prosecuting people who are competent.
But
there is a public interest in bringing to prosecution people who are competent and not committing people who are competent.
The due process right is not implicated in a former attorney's testimony, due process right of the defendant.
Whether there's an ongoing duty to that client at that point, there certainly is an ongoing duty attorney-client relationship with respect to the privilege. The duty to protect their due process rights is not direct as with the trial attorney. But also, you don't have some of the problems that you have with the current attorney being asked for their opinion, which is what Judge Fine raised, which is whether an attorney can act as both a witness and advocate in the same proceeding. So that falls out of the situation when you have the former attorney. Now, it seems to me what Mr. Meeks is saying is that somehow a former attorney is totally incompetent to testify at a competency hearing, because if what happened here violated attorney-client privilege, I can't imagine what any attorney could say that wouldn't violate the privilege. And I also very much agree with Justice Bablich that their position is totally inconsistent with State versus Johnson, and if you accept Mr. Meeks's position, you will have to overrule State versus Johnson.
Oh, but that's why I asked the question. State versus Johnson, if I recall, was a current attorney, now in, you know, ineffective assistance of counsel. The attorney had letters from psychiatrists and psychologists, hard evidence, if you will. In fact, I think the opinion talks about this. Some kind of adjective before the evidence, you know, hard evidence that raised questions about the competency,
right.
And this attorney didn't, and I mean, and
but,
so.
But I think as
at current, you're dealing with the obligation of the trial counsel, as opposed to some former testimony.
But at the time that Attorney Scholes was representing Mr. Meeks, she made some decisions on whether there was reason to raise that competency, and it's this. If you can't infer from her not raising competency that she didn't have any reasonable doubt of it.
Life isn't that black and white, I don't think. Here's a 58 IQ defendant in front of me. I'm a trial court judge. You're the defense attorney, okay? And you've got this 58 IQ defendant who is also happens to be an alcoholic and probably a drug addict, and he was picked up the corner stop-and-go or shop, the quick trip, for stealing a bottle of Jim Beam, some little booze for the weekend. And you know that if you plead him guilty, he's probably going to maybe even get it reduced to an ordinance violation, $100 fine, that's it. What's your obligation as a defense attorney to raise competency and send them to Mendota?
I think very clearly under Johnson is if you have a reason to doubt from your communication with that person that they're not being able to, and it is a low standard, but they're not communicating with you, they're not able to communicate, they're not able to assist with their dissent, you need to raise that no matter what you think their quote-unquote best interests are. And that's what Johnson says. I think there's very little difference between that and what the kind of testimony that Attorney Scholes was giving in this case.
Let me tease out you believe that an attorney can even give an opinion about competency.
Yes.
But certainly you can draw inferences. Okay. Now, at that initial initial conference with the client, at least those that I used to have, I used to tell them, look, whatever is said here, whatever happens here, stays here. Now, if we were to hold the way you want us to, does an attorney have an obligation to tell the client something to the effect of, but you should be aware that as we are going through this conference, And as I, in the course of my representation, I am making assessments about your competency. And I may well be making a determination, and I will be making a determination as to whether or not you're competent. You're competent to go ahead, or you need help. Is that going to be a necessary corollary?
I don't think it's a duty of the attorney. Whether the attorney feels comfortable doing that, and whether
okay, you don't think it's a duty, but let's assume that to some clients, and I'm sure this is true, some clients. Being found incompetent to proceed is even worse than being found guilty. And they don't want to be found incompetent. You know, they'd rather serve the time and get out. So shouldn't that client be told, hey, if you are truthful with me and tell me that you hear voices and that you see elephants in your living room, I'm going to make an assessment that you might not be competent. Therefore, I'm not going to tell you that. Now, haven't you really interfered, hasn't this rule of law really interfered with the communication between a client and an attorney? Because an attorney should know if his client hears voices or sees elephants in living rooms.
Well, I don't think, if that's what's necessary, it hasn't changed since State versus Johnson, because State versus Johnson...
Well, maybe State versus Johnson is wrong. I'm really examining the fundamentals here. Would you agree that there is a, if we adopt your rule of law, we are essentially potentially raising a barrier to communication between a client and a lawyer?
I think not on the substance of the representation, not on the substance of representing the person at trial for guilt or innocence. I think that I stress that the competency issue is different in nature, and that the competency issue is a situation that Johnson understood where the adversarial positions are not as clearly defined as they are in other situations, and that the state's interests and the public's interests weigh into it, and that it is in nobody's interest that a competent person not be tried, that a competent person be committed, or that an incompetent person be tried.
Ms. Prey, the defense counsel here made the motion on incompetence, right?
Yes.
What about an argument of waiver? Once defense counsel does that, anything that relates to the competence is waived, whether it be whether it be doctors, whether it be former lawyers, whether it be the wife, spouse, all these privileges are waived in relation to, say, communications that relate to competence.
Well, that isn't the stance that the state has taken. That is a possible argument. I think the waiver argument would be a closer call if you were in the situation where you went through the whole trial process proceeding and you're bringing either an ineffective assistance of counsel claim or whatever for not raising the competency issue. And then clearly you are attacking the attorney's.
On the civil side, if you raise a question and you want damages for your injuries, you've opened up your medical records.
Right.
So I'm saying to you, on the criminal side, you raise a question about your mental health. And here he had two issues. One, whether this was not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect, which was one of his defenses. As well as incompetence to stand trial. Why don't we say you waived matters that relate to your mental health?
Well, he certainly waived any confidentiality with the psychiatrist privilege.
That's established law.
Right. And it certainly is possible that this court could find that he's waived the privilege with respect to his previous attorney, if that becomes relevant. I must stress that, again, this was somewhat of an unusual case, and this idea that we're creating a big slippery slope and that former attorneys will be called all the time, I don't think necessarily will happen. in many cases that information may not be relevant. It was relevant in this case because of you're looking at the present competence of the person when they're in a, and in this case, there was evidence that this person, because it was based on his developmental disability rather than some sort of psychosis, that his mental status had been the same over time. Well, that's not going to be the situation in a lot of cases, so that in a lot of cases, former attorneys' testimony won't be relevant or will have more minimal relevance. Again, I think this is an unusual case in that sense.
I have another question for you. We have a very lengthy, well-thought-out opinion by the Court of Appeals. Should we just adopt it? Should we just say, I mean, you're supporting this opinion.
Yes.
Should we just adopt it? Is there anything you think should be changed, cautioned? Would you prefer just the simple opinion of Judge Fine saying, hey, it's not a confidential communication? For me, that ends the analysis.
I think the Court of Appeals got it right.
Part of the Court of Appeals?
I think the majority opinion got it right. I think perhaps in this particular case, because of the limited testimony of the attorney, they wouldn't have had to go as far as they did. But I think what they said was correct. They adopted the more substantial body of case law that a person, an attorney, can testify and render an opinion about their client's competence as long as they don't reveal the statements. And they limited that to a competency proceeding because of the special kind of nature of a competency proceeding.
Counsel, if I may, Chief, assuming, and I know in your brief you disagree with the interpretation of your opponent regarding the majority opinion's discussion on officer of the court.
Right.
Assume, if you will, that your opposing counsel is correct in his interpretation regarding the majority opinion's discussion of officer of the court. Do you support majority opinion's discussion of officer of the court, assuming it's as correct?
I guess you'll have to explain to me what you think my opponent's position is on officer of the court, just so I know what I'm agreeing or disagreeing to.
He is reading, and that's very fair. Thank you for pushing me on that. He, in essence, is saying that he reads the majority opinion, that your obligation as an officer of the court is equal to or trumps your obligation to your client, and that the discussion in the Court of Appeals opinion can be cited for that premise. If he is correct that it can be cited for that premise, do you agree with that premise?
I think it depends on how you define what your obligation to your client is.
You believe that the obligation of an attorney as an officer of the court trumps attorney-client privilege?
I'm sorry to do this to you, but it depends on how you define attorney-client privilege. And I think they can all be made to work here, that the obligation of first, I'll answer directly. No, I don't think you can to violate the attorney-client privilege. But I don't think by offering an opinion about a person's competence and not revealing the statements that you have violated the attorney-client privilege. And I think a person's duty to their client in the competency area includes making sure that your client is not committed if they are competent and that they are not tried if they are incompetent.
I don't want to quarrel on this point because I agree with you. I don't think it makes a difference here. But the attorney-client privilege is not absolute. There is no privilege that is absolute. And the duty of the attorney to the court sometimes does trump the attorney-client privilege. And there's plenty of law on that. And there are exceptions embodied in the privilege itself that set that out.
Absolutely. I'm not talking about this specific delineated exception.
So there's nothing
certainly
wrong with the Court of Appeals' generic statement that sometimes the duty of the attorney to the court as an officer of the court will override the attorney-client privilege. That's a non-controversial proposition.
I will accept that.
Thank you.
Or whom I said.
Thank you, Ms. Bray. Mr. Van Wagner, if you'd like your 5 minutes or less.
If the court please or less. Just a couple things that I'm going to respond to. The minority view, as laid out in the petitioner's brief, I think respectfully ensures the quality of the attorney-client relationship, which is the reason the privilege exists, just as it does with doctors and clergy. And I don't want to forget that when we get to the discussion of the truth-seeking function of the court. The state's position here at oral argument was that the truth-finding function of the court allows the attorney to offer things that otherwise might be considered privileged. I respectfully disagree that would be permitted because of the fact that the communications by the client were made in the communications of a non-verbal nature and of a verbal nature not disclosed here were made to the lawyer at a time when the client had no expectation that information could or would be revealed. And so I think that it would be wise to pay attention carefully, Justice Sykes, to that body of law, but ensure that in the case of a person facing a life sentence in a criminal case, the privilege isn't too easily overridden.
No, and I understand that. And you don't disagree that the privilege is not absolute. Sometimes it gives way to the attorney's duties as an officer of the court. The crime fraud exception is a prominent example.
The privilege is not universal, but there are areas where it is clearly absolute. If a person confesses to their lawyer they committed a crime and they go to trial and are found not guilty, not testifying, that lawyer can never be forced to reveal that information unless some exception applies. So there are absolute privileges, but there may not be a universal privilege.
But there are attorney-client privileged communications that nonetheless the attorney will be compelled to reveal under certain circumstances if the exceptions apply.
Yes, so absolutely. I want to come to two last points. The question came up, Justice Bradley asked whether or not different standards apply. Well, first the Court of Appeals said they don't. In the Court of Appeals decision in paragraph 40, the Court of Appeals in the principal opinion said these principles logically apply not only to a defendant's trial counsel, but the prior counsel as well. And this is a problem because, as a practical matter, if the question is privilege, the answer has to be clear regardless of which attorney the question is directed to. If the communication is privileged, it's going to be true as to the current attorney and the previous attorney. And I hear the state conceding that they would not want the unseemly posture of a trial attorney subpoenaed in his own motion to determine competency to testify. But under the proposal they put forward today, which goes further than the Court of Appeals went, that would be permitted. That can't be.
Isn't there another rule that prohibits that?
Pardon me?
Isn't there another rule that prohibits that, the rule against the attorney being a witness?
Well, there's an ethics rule that raises the attorney's ethical duty, but the fact of the matter is the privilege has to apply to both. And the in the context of the ethics rule, that's the attorney's problem vis-a-vis the Office of Lawyer Regulation, not vis-a-vis
privilege. It's also a rule that has some implications in litigation because the attorney in that instance would have to withdraw.
Absolutely.
Before being called as a witness. So that doesn't answer the privilege question, which is the point that you were making, I think.
It does not. But I think that on the issue of privilege, as we discuss the issue of privilege, it has to be the same as to current and previous counsel. And just the notion that current counsel could, but for an ethics rule, be permitted to offer that opinion to the court on the stand under oath, which is what the state's position would be if they ask you to uphold the Court of Appeals decision, I think that goes too far. I want to finish with, yes, Justice
Before Ballard. You finish. I think we all agree that Johnson stands for the proposition that an attorney has an obligation to raise.
I've never been given that signal to quit before. I apologize.
Like an arrow through the heart. Don't be alarmed.
This is the first Wednesday of the month, and on the first Wednesday of the month at 11 o'clock, the alarms are tested. So,
so our council at the bench.
I was going to say, we would not keep you in a dangerous position. If you see the bench leave, that's your first signal to get out. But that is the, and it never fails to make me jump. I think I became accustomed to it by now, but I have not. Counsel, proceed.
Okay.
Whatever you were saying.
Johnson stands for the proposition that an attorney, you have an obligation to raise the issue of competency if you have reason to question your client's competency, correct?
It says that.
Yes. Now, do we have to, I'll get to the last question first. I'll give you a context. Are we going to have to overrule Johnson? Because but now I'm going to get back to the preliminary question. Do you think Johnson raises an obligation that an attorney has to a client to tell the client that during the course of this representation I am going to be making determinations about competency, which I may have to reveal to the court?
To answer your question, I don't believe Johnson needs to be overridden. I think it needs to be limited. I think it needs to be limited in the following fashion. The ABA standards for criminal justice, which are, in fact, part of the well-written appeals court opinion here, note that it is not considered a mandatory duty, but an advised duty. The language specifically is defense counsel should move for evaluation of the defendant's competence to stand trial whenever the defense counsel has a good faith doubt. And your scenario left a practical reality that goes on every day. When a client has the opportunity to resolve serious criminal charges on a basis with which the client clearly agrees and should agree from all viewpoints of counsel, even if there is a doubt about competency, were the counsel then to raise that, that opportunity might evaporate. And those times the lawyer really has to step into the void and make that decision. They're limited. And in a first-degree homicide case, I don't think that's going to arise unless you're offered a disorderly conduct. So to answer your question, I believe that it can be limited in that respect by adopting the ABA standard as opposed to the mandatory rule, which went further than the standard.
Do you, as a matter of practice, tell your client that you're making observations about his competency?
I have only told that to a client once I've begun to question whether they were competent.
Mm-hmm.
No. But if I may face the prospect of testifying against them someday, even though I have no doubt about their competency, I may have to start telling them that if the appeals court decision is upheld. I lost maybe 60 seconds to the alarm, and I just want to conclude with a thought, Chief Justice.
If I may.
Justice Bradley had a good question. If not the psychologist's and expert's testimony, then to what did Judge Lamellis default when she made her decision? Counsel's answer is accurate to an extent. But the fact of the matter is that a prior lawyer's testimony essentially served to bolster the notion of malingering, is what I'm hearing. And if your prior counsel's general testimony about how I would have raised it if I thought it was an issue can let a judge then conclude that the client is malingering, we have maybe the most serious contravention of that relationship, because the privilege extends forever, even though the relationship may end. And so to allow that here would essentially allow Judge Lamellis's ruling to rely on the inference that malingering must be the correct conclusion. So on that basis, I believe I've stated all my arguments. Thank you very much.
Mr. Van Wagner, I have one
yes.
question. You are arguing what you concede is the minority rule.
It appears to be.
And I think you've made a very compelling argument of how you might react if Wisconsin adopts the majority rule. Is there any evidence that the sky has fallen in those states that have the majority rule?
I haven't visited the decisional follow-up to those cases to see if it is, but competency is rarely raised to begin with, and in those cases where it is raised by counsel, it's a very involved proceeding, obviously, and in those cases where the state normally faces what they faced here, which is all experts, state and defense, agreeing, it's usually the end of the day. Here, the state went further. So to answer your question directly, I don't think it's going to come up often. And so I don't think that the sky is falling there and would here. What I am concerned about is sending a signal to DAs that if all the experts line up and agree that competence will not be regained, we have one last tool. Let's call the previous lawyers. Let's give them a subpoena. Let's put them on the stand and fish for something here. That's my concern.
Thank you, Mr. Van Wagner, and thank you, Ms. Prey, both of you, for excellent arguments on an issue that has not previously come to court. And we especially want to thank Mr. Van Wagner for taking this case on a pro bono basis. And welcome you to this court, your first argument, and come back again soon. Pro bono or not.
That's up to you.
All right. Okay. And Ms. well stated, Mr. Van Wagner. And Ms. Prey is a frequent arguer here, and we're always delighted to see her. We'll take a few moments in recess so students may leave and other students may come in.